Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Human Values Club podcast. You're here today with us. We're going to have a great conversation. Can I hear hello from everybody?
Hi.
Hi.
We have some beautiful people today, people that you already know. And we have a special, special, special guest today. We have Kaden here. How are you?
I am great. How are you?
I'm good. I'm glad we're here with you. Can you tell us a little bit about you, just so people can know something interesting?
I can. Where to start? I'm a recent grad. I studied education and research, and that's something that I really want to go to grad school for. I am currently unemployed. So if anybody has any job openings, let me know. Shameless plug, but no, I honestly, this time has been, I think, almost more educational than anything that I've learned in school, anything that I've done in any degree program. So I'm just really taking this time right now to let that shape my thoughts on what my future looks like. So that is me.
Awesome. And you see, Katie is, you like, this person is so humble and she knows so much stuff and she's a great person. So if you ever get to meet her in person, 100% would recommend. So before we get into our topic, we have some bits and bobs. And
bits and bobs.
We
bits and
have
bobs, bits and bobs.
A new song for you. We have now a Ko-fi where you can donate monies to sponsor either our audio equipment or any other thing that helps the Human Values Club in a podcast. So you can go to Ko-fi, which is spelled K-O-F-I. Say it with me.
K-O-F-I.
Now for real. ko-fi.com/Human Values Club. So if you have to remember it, just sing the little song, ko-fi.com/Human Values Club. You can donate the price of a coffee, which right here in Chicago is about $4 to $5. Support this cause so you can help us in that way. Also, you can contact us at humanvaluesclub@gmail.com. Send us any comments you have or any suggestions, any encouragement. That helps us a lot. As well, you can follow us in social media. Instagram, at Human Values Club. Same as Twitter. And YouTube, you can find us as the Human Values Club. Awesome. So today, if you are willing to join us in a meditation, This is very nice to take just a time to breathe and a time to be with ourselves. So right there, listener, wherever you are, if you want to sit up straight in your chair, in your couch, in your bed while you're cooking, listening to this podcast, take a moment to close your eyes. Maybe you should stop cooking if you're meditating with us. Close your eyes. Take a deep breath in. Breathe in for four, one, two, three, four, and breathe out for four, four, three, two, one. Okay, let's try that one time. Breathe in, one, two, three, four, and breathe out for four, three, two, one. And today we're going to do a body meditation, which means with your hands, you're going to massage your hand, your arms, your shoulder, and just let's feel ourselves in our body. Usually in difficult times, we are all in our minds, and it's hard to remember that we're in this body, and our body helps us do all the things that we need to get done and that we need to do. So let's thank our hands and our arms for letting us do good things. And then just move down to your legs, massage your leg as you're able, and thank your legs for taking you to good places, for helping you assist other people and help other people. And then go up to your shoulder, massage your shoulder, shoulders. If you don't have someone next to you, that's fine because you can massage your shoulders and do something nice for yourself. So whatever is happening in your life right now, know that you have us, you have other people around you that take care of you, and we are so grateful for those people. Let's take a last deep breath in. 1, 2, 3, 4, and breathe out. 4, 3, 2, 1. All right, open your eyes. Stretch if you need to. As we get ready for the discussion of today. So, what a week, y'all. It's election week. And it seems, as I saw one of my friends say, this is the longest Tuesday in my life. And maybe you can share about how we're feeling this week. From that, we thought it was a good opportunity to talk about civic education and why it is important. Most of you might have experienced during this time that you're like, I was not taught that in school, or like, I didn't know the elections in the U.S. work that way, etc., etc. So it's super important. So we're going to talk about why it's important. And also, since most of us are teachers and work with children, why it's important to talk with children about politics, and why it's hard to talk with other people, and how can we prepare ourselves and our students for civic engagement. So if that sounds good to you, stay with us. We're going to have our dearest Melody lead us into this conversation. Melody, take it away.
Thank you, dearest Andrea. Welcome, everybody, to this conversation. I'm actually really excited to talk about this, but a little bit nervous because I feel like, personally, politics and the idea of civic education is something that I've just never really had good conversations about these things, at least in my past. I think now I'm starting to dive in with some of my friends and but it's always an area where I try not to go to, especially with people I'm not very familiar with, because politics, I heard one time or read that religion and politics can be the two main dividers in the world, sadly. But I looked up civic education the other day, and some of the words that I found, I just want to share with you. Democracy, rights, citizen, knowledge, skill, empowerment, experiential learning, voice. So these are some of the words that came up for me. And I don't know how I feel about that, because sometimes we have certain feelings or ideas attached to words. And so everybody has a feeling or opinions attached to politics or attached to what civic education is. And I was listening to a podcast by Oprah called Oprah's Masterclass, and she had a conversation with Condoleezza Rice, who's the one of the first Black female national security advisors. She's a former one now. And Condoleezza was kind of sharing, as a child, her parents created this kind of democratic household where they would have a pretend vote session and she would always win the election in her house. Like, she always won. Her parents always lost. And looking back on that, she shared that they definitely did that on purpose. And the point of that was so that she felt empowered, but also that she had responsibility, because once she was in that seat, she could be part of making decisions like what color should we paint the kitchen or how much money should we spend on snacks or whatever it was. And so as a child, she shared that was an empowering experience for her, but it also taught her a lot about what is democracy and also just the responsibilities of being in positions of power. And in my personal experience, I think I didn't talk very much about politics with my parents, but they always were big on it's important to vote and things like that. So I want to throw this question to my friend Victoria.
Yes.
And yeah, just leading with all of that and some of the words I mentioned and the idea of what civic education is, as a child, what was it like for you learning about politics? And did you have voices in your life who taught you about, you know, what civic education is, or the importance of learning about the political atmosphere in your country? Yeah, what was that like for you growing up as a child? And how has that transformed over the years in your life?
Thanks for passing it to me. I could like feel you like about to say my name. I was like, say it. Yes. So, however, sadly enough, my civic education when I was younger was very lacking, and it's almost a little disappointing looking back on it. I feel like in school, I barely remember social studies in school. I barely remember us even talking about like taxes and, you know, like barely talking about a stock market, like, and then let alone talking about how to vote. Besides the history, which is, you know, as we all know, not very truthful in a lot of aspects, but we learned about when, you know, voting was given to women finally, but we didn't really learn how, like, how influential, you know, people of color and Black women were for getting women's rights to vote. So that was just, it was only, you know, so there was that, there's that. And then I feel like my mom, who is very, like, up to date with politics, and we talk about it a lot now, had a conversation with her the other day about it and about all of the election things. But I feel like we didn't really have meaningful conversations when I was growing up about it. You know, she would tell me, you know, going to vote, blah, blah, blah. If I would ask questions, she would obviously answer my questions, but I didn't really know the questions to ask. And I didn't really see the wider scope of like, well, yeah, when we grow up and when we vote, we, you know, vote for president. That's it. You know, I didn't really think, oh, wherever you live, you have to read up on who is running your city, who is the judge in your city, who is this and this. And so the scope of everything and the like the weight of it was never given to me. And I feel like I have a lot of catching up to do, like you were saying, where it's just like in our past, it's just like politics was nothing. We would just know who was good and who was bad from, you know, news or opinions that our parents would have, or if they would even say anything at all, you know? But I do remember in high school, my amazing orchestra teacher, she, when Obama got elected the first time and we were in orchestra, thankfully, she had us watch his inauguration, and it was awesome. And it was like so important to her, which made it like more important to me, even though I didn't really like, I was still pretty young. I guess I wasn't that young. I was naive, we'll put it that way. And I just remember her being fired up and then her explaining to me like, this is a big moment in history that none of you guys should miss. And this is a big moment in, you know, history for everybody, but also for, you know, a man of color being in the Oval Office, such and such, all that. So I was really like thankful that that kind of like started my like passion, I guess, and wanting to know more. But yeah, long story long, very like all the civic education I've had has been recent, you know, like as an adult, post-college. Yeah. So also very thankful that we're having this conversation, because I too will be learning a lot from these lovely faces. And I'm curious to see who had a really good childhood civic education, because I want to take that and roll with it and shove it into kids' faces.
Yeah, so
perfect choice of words.
Yeah. Shove it in there.
you mentioned, you said that your orchestra teacher was important to her, and you could, I'm paraphrasing, but you could feel that, you could feel how important it was to her based on how she spoke about it and the fact that she shared. So I have a question for you, and anybody else who wants to jump in if this connects to their experience. Do you feel like it wasn't as important to your parents, or were they protecting you because they didn't want to burden you with the idea of, oh, my daughter has to think about politics? Like, what is the difference there between your orchestra teacher and your parents in how they conveyed what politics is to them?
It's interesting, and I'll pass it on to anybody after I say one more quick thing among the many. My mom, she was like almost like the opposite of like a helicopter parent. Like, she let us figure out on our own what we needed to do. So I don't know if it was like she was trying to shelter me from politics. I don't think that was ever the case, but I think she wanted to let me figure things out on my own, which has pros and cons when you're someone who just doesn't know anything about it, and doesn't know what to ask. So I think there was that, but also my orchestra teacher was like my second mother. So in a way, and my mom has said that too. She's like, Mrs. Black was like, you know, I was so like grateful for her, 'cause she was like your mom at school. And I was like, yeah, totally. But yeah, so I think maybe that's why, 'cause I looked up to her so much as I wanted to be her, as a career, you know, music teacher. I wanted to, you know, love people the way she loved people. And also I wanted to be as involved politically as she was. She knew everything. She knew everything about what was going on in the world. And I just wanted to also be that knowledgeable. So I kind of want to ask my mom, hey, what's the deal? I think I could ask her that now and be like, so when I was growing up, did you have a reason for, you know, but yeah.
That's a good question, and maybe a piece of homework right there.
Yes.
So I think the opposite of helicopter parenting is submarine parenting, right? They just shoot you off into the world like,
Did you just make that up?
Yeah, well, that's what I was... I don't have a response to the actual question, but I have that. You're welcome.
Necessary.
But I think it is interesting to go back and like, did you know, to our parents, did you think about civic education when I was growing up? And I'm probably from a single mom, my mom would be like, no, I was just trying to like feed you. And, you know, which, you know, for me, people are going to get tired of it, but it always points me back to Bettina Love, and we want to do more than survive. Because if we are still surviving, we are not able to reach those things through which we will thrive. So, you know, I've been talking a lot to a lot of you about that, of civic education, financial literacy, tech literacy, like these classes that would be really, really helpful. But yeah, staying on civic education, I feel like when I really think about it, I got a lot of my civic education from music, from rock and roll. I really, especially like right before going to high school, and I kind of started playing guitar, was because of Jimi Hendrix. And so, like, I know there was a song of his, and he fought, he was a vet of the Vietnam War. He was a paratrooper, but he got hurt and honorably discharged pretty early on. But just listening to him, listening to the Beatles, listening to a lot of protest music from that time kind of activated me a little bit, and like my interest in thinking about the Vietnam War and how every war up until then, you know, there was kind of this justification one could make an argument for, but that when the Vietnam War happened, that was the beginning of a real split between the elite of the country and the counterculture. And I always kind of identified with that countercultural perspective. So I think that's when I started to become politicized, and it was mainly through stories and through role models. And like, I would just like read biographies and things like that, and, you know, get interested in all of the cool activism that, you know, people were doing, and then kind of like unfolding, you know, through studying. It just like became very glaring. Like when I think I went to school for music, but I didn't know about Nina Simone and how she was part of the civil rights movement. You know, there were like, you know, Sui Jiang is a Chinese musician. He's called the grandfather of Chinese rock, who did a protest song after the Tiananmen Square massacre. Is it Victor Jara was a Chilean musician that protested a lot of really difficult, dark times that the country of Chile went through. So just like those stories were the stories that really inspired me from a musical perspective of these people that use their music for social change, which was awesome. And now we have India Ari, so shout out to India Ari.
Oh my gosh, that's good stuff right there.
If I could just jump in on that, it really makes me think that the things that tend to activate people the most are the arts, because they are so visual or interactive. And so, like, it's putting a face or an image or a sound to this pain that people share but don't have words to express, really. So it's kind of this thing that, like, can be, like, the awakening of, like, oh, wait, there are other people in the world who feel this way. Okay, now let me find my community. So I just wanted to hop in and say that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think just now a thought came to my head. When I asked this question about civic education, I was thinking that we need to... The people who teach us about those things are our parents or teachers, but sometimes a movement or a song or a specific person who we never meet is the teacher. I'm just thinking about Nina Simone and her story. A powerful human being, just so much depth to who she was, but so much pain in her story. And... the documentary about her is really great. I think it's still on Netflix. I'm not sure.
It's called What Happened, Miss Simone.
Yes, there it is. And there's a part that that kind of talks about how she gave up some of her being popular in her career field specifically to have a voice, to speak up against injustices. And that she lost a lot of her fans and a lot of her gigs because of that period of time where she chose to do this work and she chose to write songs that were just very verbally aggressive or that just spoke the truth. And so after that movement, when a lot of the people who were with her died, like Martin Luther King, and she had a hard time transitioning back into... Now I'll just do what I did before. She couldn't do that because she had lost so many, you know, just people were not very happy with what she had said and the person that she had become in the time of the movement. And so she kind of sacrificed for the sake of what is right and just and fair. She sacrificed fame pretty much and is still famous, like well-known now if we look back on it. But for her, that was a big sacrifice, because after that, it's like, now what do I do? And so she left the country. And so I'm just, you know, I'm just thinking a little bit about the teachers in our lives. Like, what does that mean and how we learn? Andrea, if I can put you on the spot, what is it? Because you're not from here. You're Costa Rican. And so as a child growing up and being in a different political climate, America is different from Costa Rica. How has your civic education growing up influenced, you know, how you make decisions today in America?
Ooh, girl. I feel like I've been in the U.S. for, what, 5-6 years, and I feel like I'm like a 6 year old learning about American politics. So that's how I feel. But I think, I mean, Costa Rica is a democracy and has always been. It's a young country, but we pride ourselves in that, like, oh, we're a democracy. And compared to, let's say, other countries in Latin America that have been impacted by dictatorships, like, we honor ourselves in our democracy. That doesn't mean that there hasn't been corrupt systems and corrupt politicians, which unfortunately is common in Latin America. But I think growing up, of course, we learn in school, like, the structure of the system in Costa Rica and, like, voting and everything. But if your parents were not politicians, you would not speak that much about politics, at least in my family, let's say. So, like, my family was not really, like, a family of politicians. So it was very much, like, we still voted. And, you know, we'd still, like, inform ourselves a little bit of, like, who we're voting for. But, we wouldn't be as involved if our like someone in our family was not a politician. Mm-hmm. And so I feel, honestly, how it has been influenced me is, I think, fear of talking about it or fear of going too deep into it or to be bold and say, like, oh, this is what I believe in, or, like, this politician is not doing this, or this politician is not doing that. Because up until now, which, because of the pandemic and just civil unrest in general in Costa Rica, there's been groups coming out as, you know, kind of, like, on the violent side and kind of, like, protests here, like, well, people are just tired of not enough funds, not enough resources for specific communities. And that is seen as, like you better, like, not identify with your family if you are being part of one of those, let's say, those protests or those people that are leading these acts of civil unrest, so of civil disobedience, let's say. And so, honestly, yeah, it's been as like, a fear thing. I'm scared of saying my position in something political, which like, I've heard other people, like, oh, I don't talk about politics, but really everything is about politics and it affects our everyday life. Mm-hmm. So I think,
yeah,
even with my parents, even I know moving here, unfortunately, you know, I'm a permanent resident, but still, you know, there's real fear that my status can be revoked. And now, like, how we are all monitored online, and when we applied for our green card, you know, we had to show evidence of everything, and, like, social media was part of it. Like, what do you post on social media can be used, you know, against you. And so I know when I start speaking to my parents about, you know, like, say my opinion about a politician or a policy or something politically related, they're like, yeah, but remember, like, don't say too much, or, like, remember that your status is still blah, blah, blah. And so, yes, I've been battling with those things of the fear of speaking out and speaking about politics and being open with my opinions and what I stand for. So,
yeah,
I think it's a balance, and it's a real fear. Like, I think about undocumented immigrants in the U.S. and this fear of speaking up and fighting for our rights when it directly could affect, like, your whole life and like your life here. So, constantly think about that.
Yeah, it's like you have to fine-tune your thoughts and your voice to please, you know, where you're staying. And I think that it's really sad, because I think, going back to how powerful everyone's voice is and how we should have the opportunity to speak honestly and openly about what we think about things, because, you know, just the idea that some voices matter or some people are American, like what exactly defines being American, or somebody who was undocumented for a period of time and recently gained citizenship, how important their voice is versus somebody who's was born and raised, you know, it's all, there's this strange idea about around whose voice matters or whose voice has power. And I think that ties into how, you know, how we approach, as teachers, how we approach teaching, how we approach teaching as teachers, civic education in the classroom. It's like, how do we talk about voting to a Black kid who's maybe whose great grandmother or grandmother even thought, my voice doesn't matter, so I don't need to vote. So they're coming from a home hearing maybe that, compared to, you know, a white kid who grew up on in the suburbs, whose parents are very open and strong about their opinion of politics. Like in the classroom setting, how do you talk about that, and how do you address and reach the hearts of all these kids and help them think critically? And anyway, that is actually my second question, and I'm going to throw that at Katie. Katie, you shared that you're interested in educational research, so I'm curious to know your thoughts around how to teach honest civic education in a classroom setting, but also just generally in having a conversation with a 10-year-old in a park or whatever it is. What are your thoughts around that?
So I don't know if you can see, but all my hairs are standing up on edge. I've been itching to get to this. I'm like, I want to talk about this so much. So just before I start, I just want to like decenter myself a little bit and say that I am really new to abolition work. So I do want to credit all of my knowledge and things that I'm talking about right now to the people of color, specifically, women and femmes of color who have like carved this knowledge out and have shared their like just depths of knowledge with us. So those are the folks that I really want to turn to in this time and their theories. And so for me, it going back to why is it so hard to talk about politics, I feel like it's designed that way. So if you think about it, the founding fathers, and these are like, you know, the I don't want to call them always dog whistles, but these terms that kind of send that like specific groups of people use to try and hold on to their power or you know, stake their claim, is that these founding fathers, they never wanted women or enslaved people or immigrants to have a say, because we were never part of the plan, right? They were the plan. So they sold the American people, which they didn't really have to sell anybody other than the white men, right? Because those are the people who were only, like, women could not own a house. They were treated as property. So they sold the American people an elite democracy, which is when a small number of people usually who are, like, the wealthy or educated folks. And when I say educated, I mean, at that time, who were the people who actually had access to education? And those small number of people are the people who influence all of the political decision making. And what they did is they disguised it as this participatory democracy, which is a democracy in which people actually have the power to make policy decisions and to influence policy decisions by creating the electoral college system. And so, like, if you dive really deep into that, there's so much variance, like, by state in terms of, like, what the restrictions are for voting against what the majority is. So let's say Chicago, it would never happen in Chicago, but let's just say there was an elector who just decided to vote Republican instead of Democrat in this specific election. it's so drastically different what the penalties are for doing that. Sometimes that penalty could be as low as a fine, which what does that tell you? Is that if you have money, you can influence politics. So for me, it's like these gatekeeping systems that are like this are meant to maintain the status quo, which is a rich elite. And it's a rich white elite because that those are the people who had access to education, to building generational wealth, to all of these other things. And so then on top of that, the thing that Andrea was talking about in terms of that like fear of talking to people or speaking out or going against the grain, for lack of a better word, is that at some point we were sold the narrative that it's taboo to discuss or debate politics. And so in order to actively fight that, that can only start where there isn't already, I keep throwing around this word jaded, and I don't want that to make people think that I don't believe that people can change, but I feel like people's capacity for accepting this information, that when you grew up in a system like me, where my education, I went to a small Lutheran school from the time I was 3 until 8th grade, and then only was my experience with a Chicago public high school. And our civic education literally consisted of whatever the state required. Mm-hmm. And thinking back on it, all I can remember is like having some kind of constitution class or a constitution test or something. So anything and everything that we did that had to do with politics was just rote memory. So it was, we had the songs about the constitution, we had the amendment song to remember and all these different hand signals, because they wanted us to pass the test. They wanted us to score well so that we could move on to the next grade. But there was never any active interest in empowering us.
Yeah.
In talking about how those systems work, what the structures of these systems are, and is there a way to change them if they're unfair? So instead of, in my opinion, instead of teachers' goal being, I want to warn my students, I want to warn them about how unfair the world is, if we can teach them about the systems in such graphic detail that they understand how they work and where the potential for change is, that's the only way to empower students, in my opinion, to give them agency, to know that they can affect the world around them.
Mm-hmm. It's about honesty, like being brutally honest, and it might be confusing, but it's, we want to invite students to the table, not like scare them away from the table and just be like, the Constitution is hard to memorize. Like, ooh, you know, it should be about honesty.
Yeah. And also with sorry, Javi, I don't know if I interrupted you there. Just with the idea of teaching kids in a way that empowers them, causes them to challenge to challenge the systems. It's like if they become critical thinkers, they will disagree with things, and that's dangerous. So we're trying, it's almost like we're trying to keep things in order and make sure there's not too much change. So let's just teach them let's just teach them the knowledge, the vague stuff, so they can pass the test and keep going, instead of teaching them how to think critically, how to understand in depth how these systems work and what democracy means in America and how it came to be, the history of it and what it the purpose that it serves. And so from that understanding comes a deeper thinking, and from deeper thinking comes disagreeing and radical, this is wrong, or this is right, or this doesn't work, or this is a corrupt way of approaching it.
Yes.
Yeah, so.
And I just to piggyback off of that, I don't think I ever had anyone talk about critical thinking or like what critical thinking was until college. Mm-hmm. And then at that, I only had one professor who the only reason that I learned so much was because I made sure to take every one of the English classes that he offered at the university. But because he would teach us things like, what's a logical fallacy? Like, how do you identify them? And I was like, whoa, if I had learned this in high school, do you know how much more critical I would have been of the sources that I was citing or the things that I was, like, saying, like, basing my claims off of? Like, it just, if you can start that earlier than in college, which is when I think most people are exposed to it for the first time, because elementary school teachers are, sorry, not elementary, elementary and high school, grade school teachers in general are rightfully scared to rock the boat. And so if teachers are as well are forced to exist, I'm also reading Bettina Love, and if they're forced to exist within this educational survival complex all the time, there is no room for growth. There is no time to get to know your students. Everything is prescribed. Everything is, but whose standards are we living up to? Whose standards are we trying to live up to? It's the textbook companies. Because the textbook companies have had profits poured into them and have money and are able to affect legislation and are able to lobby and are able to say, hey, we want you guys to follow this curriculum because it aligns with this new book that we just published. And we're going to make $17 billion off of it. So when you as a teacher, when you are faced with making that decision of, do I want to teach my kids for what's going to give them the tools that they need to succeed in life? Or am I going to teach my kids what I'm being told to teach my kids, which is basically capitalism in a book?
Right.
Because they're not going to give you any of the tools that you need to change the system. They want you to stick within the system.
So I think a wonderful opportunity to jump off of that, because I don't even remember what the question was anymore, but so much good stuff. How do you engage your students in civic education? I think the golden opportunity is kind of what Katie is talking about there. Of, I think I had a discussion with one of my clubs this week, and saying, like, you know, you all can, you can demand what classes you want to take. What classes would you want to take? And what I'm hearing over and over again is financial literacy, how to do my taxes, how to buy a car, how to buy a house, how to make investments, right? Retirement plan, stock market, and then, life skills. With all the conversation happening now, there's a lot of everyone should take either an anti-bias class or a class about racial literacy. And then all of the different, like, you know, African-American studies, African-American literature. There's literary activism. Shout out to Andy, one of the teachers at the school. And there are a lot of classes that, you know, this class is something that they're going to forget as soon as the class is over. Shout out to all my science and math people. I love you. But does everyone need to take trig? Does every high school student really need to take trig?
Right.
I'm not. Prove me wrong, people. Prove me wrong. humanvaluesclub@gmail.com.
Well, and then you think about, well, some people, I mean, we don't usually use these anymore, but like balancing a checkbook, figuring out interest rates on on so many things. Like, you don't learn that until you're actually in it.
How about
an adult? Like, what is this?
How about calculate the interest rate on your student loan?
Right.
You know, again, things that we're actually going to need. And I think that
budget planning,
to me, it's getting close. Yes. It's getting close to just like a human right. I think it's a human right to take this on nutrition and health and how to live well. So then I tell the kids, you know, how would we get how would we change the curriculum so that we can take out classes that you don't need? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're going into a science track, then take all the classes you want, make them those your electives, right?
Right.
How do we get rid of these requirements that everyone has to take this class, right? Mm. And it always comes back to the district. You got to go to the district office, you know, and that involves, guess what, organizing. Got to organize the teachers, got to organize the students, got to organize the parents, because at the end of the day, the parents are so powerful. Yeah. They're some of the most powerful stakeholders. But who are the parents that are least empowered? Your BIPOC parents. The ones who live 2 hours away from school, the kid is traveling 2 hours to and from, right?
And are working.
Katie, I know that was some of your research. Yeah, hardworking parents. Maybe they are not confident with their English skills. They don't show up to report card pickup. Like, there's so many things, you know. Those are not the parents calling the principal every day, like, when there's something wrong that they don't like. Like, those, you know, we can't expect those students, if they're not empowered, can't expect them to do all that self-advocacy everyone's talking about all the time, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's about, and that's the opportunity, I think, for civic education. Organize the students and make them demand what they want their school to look like.
Do you remember the most recent CPS hearing, I think it was a budget hearing or something, and they were voting on the SROs? So there was a public comment section, and this is exactly what you said, like, in real life, is there was a public comment section, and people had been, you know, like, writing up these, you know, amazing things to say about why having SROs in schools disproportionately affects students of color, and just all of these amazing things. And it just so conveniently happened that almost all of the slots had already been taken, the speaking slots, it was like 2 minutes a piece, were taken by parents and administrators from Saugeenash Elementary School, which I'm not sure if you're familiar, but it's like up on Peterson. And not to say that schools should not have the right to advocate for resources, but this is an extremely far north side, like north suburb of Chicago, that is super well funded. They already they've already gotten money for like extra buildings and things like that. And so when it comes down to this public comment section, who were the people who had the time and the resources to organize to be able to get more resources?
What's the, there's like a rule of, in a room full of stakeholders, look around and notice who's not there that should be there. And it's a big mindset change that we're asking of people in power to do, but it's about time.
It's necessary.
Yeah. And the most beautiful work I think that you can do right now is, you know, to get people activated in that way. I'm going back to my big three, which is build beloved community, build a community of people that are going to take care of each other and encourage each other, educate each other on whatever it is that you need to learn. In this case, we're talking civic education, empowering the community. And then the third thing is to organize for the policies that you want to better your life, whatever your community is. And I think those three steps are really, really amazing, whether that's at the school or whatever community that you're working for. Because I think this system, this educational survival complex, is made to make us feel alone, us feel isolated, us feel, you know, like we're the ones failing.
I think it's our fault.
When really it's a system that's been failing BIPOC students, parents, and teachers.
And it was designed to make.
Intentionally broken system, right? It's working just as it was designed to.
Yeah. I remember by my second year in college, I remember thinking to myself that school feels like it's, you know, it just feels like I'm surviving all the time. Mm-hmm. Like I'm not learning. I'm learning, but I'm not actually learning. Like I'm not,
you're,
my mind
you're
isn't.
Passing classes,
right,
and passing
so I'm
tests.
Going to class, I'm listening to a professor give me information. There isn't like enough, I feel like there wasn't enough active discussion. There wasn't enough me going back to my room and thinking, wow, this is, I need to think more about this. Like, it was just more of, oh, I need to go back to my room and do this assignment. It's due tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And I remember just feeling so angry because I love learning. I love learning about new things and challenging myself to think differently. And I remember just feeling like that was ripped away from me, like somebody stole something from me. And plus, I was paying all this money to have somebody steal something from me.
Right. Right.
And even now, I think I've gotten better at playing. A specific professor of mine, when I was having a hard day, he said to me, Melody, it's just a game. You just have to figure out how to play this game. And that has helped me so much because at this point, I feel like I just need to play the game, play it well, figure out all the ways of surviving and learning and finding ways of learning within all of it. And then once I leave this scary system, use everything that I've learned, both my terrible and good experiences, to build something better, to create something that is different to what is. Which leads me to my next question.
Oh God.
What can we do?
Transitions are so good today.
What can we do to, what is the speaking practically, what's our next step, or what's a goal that we can make for ourselves? What can we do to create a honest civic education for ourselves and our personal lives, and also just for within the education system as teachers?
I can jump in first and just kind of like what I said is make spaces. You know, the beautiful thing as a teacher, I think, is first of all to create the beloved environment. That's why we're talking about Human Values Club all the time. Human Values Education. We got that workshop coming up. But I think this, I don't know when this episode is going to come out, so hopefully you're already following us on social media. This helps me to set an environment of safety and learning in my class when I can say every week we're practicing humanity. Here's a quote of the week. Here's a song. You matter. You are valuable. It's talking about self-love every day. And just setting that tone, I think, is like the first most important thing of giving students spaces. Now, sometimes when things happen, we need to be responsive. We should try always to be responsive. And sometimes teachers may not know what to say and don't want to say the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think saying nothing is the wrong thing.
Yeah.
Because you might be afraid to hurt a student's feelings or something. But there are students who, even though it's a hard topic, the fact that you took the time to talk about something serious that happened makes them feel safer.
Mm.
And I get that comment a lot from BIPOC students of, thanks for giving us the space. And then doing alternative education. So not just, hey, here's Martin Luther King. Oh, no, he led the civil rights movement. Oh, no, he died. You know, someone killed him. But then didn't actually talk about, right, this is what Black History Month is every year. Like, well, we'll celebrate all these people. But they never talked the details of what was it that they did to organize and to change policy. Yeah. How did they recognize racist policy? How did they, take it down or replace it with anti-racist policy? What were the steps that they did? And here are the steps that you can do. Mm. And then after you've educated, then you can organize, whether it's in your class or an after-school club that can be like a human values club or, racial literacy club or a student activism club or board even, and have kids start to write, what are the policies that are harming you? What policies do you want to institute? And who are the stakeholders with the power to change those policies and how do we knock on their door? Not literally, but you know what I mean. Make good trouble, make a joyful noise. And part of it, mm-hmm. part of it too, why it's scary and why we don't want to do that as a system, is power. It is scary to give up power to students, but it will ultimately make the school better. It will ultimately make the teachers better. There's some beautiful things happening right now in this city as a response to a lot of darkness. So, but yeah, I would say build community, educate, and then organize.
I 100% am with you there. I think those two things, if you really boil it down to its essence, is first, you're uplifting people. You're making sure that they feel heard, like they have a voice, that you are listening more than you're talking. But that's just the beginning. I mean, that's like the mattering aspect, because it's really hard to give your opinion or feel brave enough to speak out if you don't feel like you have a voice or you've ever had a voice. So that uplifting part, but then the empowerment part, because if you're just talking about the civil rights movement and you're not talking about what went into it, what worked, what didn't work, how do we examining it critically, and just instead of just talking about the history, you are you're almost participating in, like, I don't know another word for it, but like trauma porn. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you're just talking about all the things that went wrong, all the people that were killed, who was assassinated, all the violence. I mean, I learned that the Black Panthers were this crazy militaristic organization. I mean, if I had learned that they were the reason that I had school in my lunch in my school, it would have been a completely different perspective. So that empowering people and giving them the tools that they need to plug into activist work at like multiple entry points. So whether that's like Javier said, giving them a space, giving them, finding an organization that once you have that conversation with your students, finding organizations that are actually already working toward the things that they want to change, that can give them a way to like plug into the work that's being done in the city, or wherever you are. But then explaining that, like, when we talk about activism, most people have this vision in their head of just like organizing rallies, organizing protests. It's all about the protests. And that is such a visible, important part of it. But there's so much more that you can do behind the scenes, whether it's attending workshops for these orgs that like are already putting out. I mean, the Defund CPD movement right now has an entire fall calendar of trainings. There's something once, twice a week that you can plug into and learn more about what's happening. There's webinars that are happening all over Facebook, Facebook Live, Instagram Live. If you're reading abolitionist texts or suggesting some of those books to your students, I was not a huge reader in high school, but I have a lot of friends who, if a teacher suggested a book, I'd see them scribbling it down in their, you know, in their planner, and they're like, I want to get that book. I want to read that book. I want to know what my teacher is learning from. Just reaching out to your neighbors, talking to your neighbors, knowing who they are, knowing who lives in your neighborhood. I feel like we're so at work at home that we lose our sense of community completely. And like knowing who your older person is, like just like what ward you live in, so that you know, okay, when the next election is coming up, did this person do things in my ward that I like? Was this person advocating for me in any way? So like, and engaging with your older people, you can give them a call. You look up their phone number, give them a call. Sometimes like it's usually only like when you want to compliment them or congratulate them on something that the office person will like patch you through to them to talk to them live. So generally you
only
have to like,
comments.
So if you can do that and then be like, oh, but,
by the way,
exactly. But like also engaging in mutual aid, that's something that is kind of a new term to me. There's a mutual aid is abolition workshop coming up real soon, next Wednesday. So check that out, Defund CPD. I think it's just at Defund CPD on Instagram. But then just a couple more things, like learning more about the untaught history of your country of origin and your country of living. Because there's so much stuff, like we said, that won't be in these history books because it is not in the interest of the person who is publishing the book to empower people, to see beyond the educational survival complex. And then, like, finally just joining any grassroots efforts that are already happening in your city, joining an action team or action pod, Human Values Club. I'm going to do a plug right now. Has a pretty awesome action team that is still really fresh, but I think has been doing a lot to create that space where young people are centered, where BIPOC voices are centered, where we can have these conversations about what abolition is. That abolition is, it's not about lack of something, it's more about presence than anything else. So joining these action teams and pods in your neighborhood, and because without all of those things, we have no chance of building a sustainable ecosystem of change that's long term. If everybody's just protesting all the time, it's great. It gets everyone riled up. But then once it dies down, what's the ask? What are we asking from the people who attended that protest? So the more you can plug in and have these conversations, I just like to remind myself every time I'm stressing and I'm like, I don't understand this. There's no way to comprehend the amount of pain that's happening in the world. If you go back to theory and you go back to the folks who have been organizing and doing this work for years, they have laid it out for us. They've laid out roadmaps of what works to change society, to change, what popular opinion is. So we forget, we get so caught up in this isolation that our society, I think, intentionally has tried to breed. And so if we can reconnect with our humanity, we can actually have a chance to build this long-term sustainable change. Hmm.
Katie, long, president.
long story.
Yes. No.
Anything is possible. Anything is possible, Katie. I just want to say that I love the last part, too, that you said of, before that, making it sustainable. And for me, like, everything I have to do as a group. That's why
I'm
the organizer. Yeah, and I have too many groups. That's part of that is making that sustainable, is having your group of people and your community that's going to keep each other, because it's not easy, right? Mm. And everyone sacrifices something. Mm. And especially being isolated all summer, and watching all these things unfold all summer, I got to a point of almost losing my humanity. And this is kind of where I feel like the pairing of civics education and human values education is so intertwined in my eyes, of the fact of let's never let go of our humanity. And as we're practicing civic education, as we're identifying racist policies, demonstrating, as well as working to change policy, that we maintain our connection to our own inner humanity, as well as seeing the humanity in others, because we neither do we want to become people who are dehumanizing others.
Mm. Yeah.
As are the people that we're often confronting. Knowingly or not. Humanity first. And I love that that those can go together. It means a lot to me to
I will
see that play out.
Say about the action team, if you're interested, I'm going to plug the social media at Human Values Club on Instagram. We always post announcements about the upcoming meetings there. But I did just want to say, I didn't really talk about what we do or what we are doing. Is that it's an action team specifically centered around young folks who are fighting for intersectional social justice. And our mission is really to empower people, all people, in this fight for liberation of all people, but also to help folks sustain it. Like we said, sustainability, being accountable to each other, creating spaces where you are truly honest about your capacity, and how you interact with the movement, That is one of our main goals. So come check us out and, or plug into this, to the many, many other things that are happening in your neighborhood, because there is a way to get involved. I promise.
Mm-hmm. Mm. There's always a way.
This is the way.
I have spoken.
All good stuff. Thank you everybody for your wisdom. I just want to pass it back to Andrea to lead us to the next segment of this podcast episode.
The next journey. Thank you, Melody. Awesome discussion. Thank you, everyone. I forgot to mention our names at the beginning, but Victoria, Javier, Melody, and Katie. Every time I'm mesmerized, by your wisdom and just your knowledge and the openness that we have to just talk about topics that might be not our focus or our strength, but that we are open to talking about it and just diving deep. And I just wanted to add something, because you also mentioned, Melody, about how to deal with that in our own lives. And I'm figuring that out still, and I think it's a constant thing to do. But I've been reading The Voice of Knowledge by Don Miguel Ruiz. And what actually clicked while we were speaking to me, the something that I wrote, that we are perfect. You know, just how we are born, we are perfect. And I know that might bring up like thoughts right away, like, what are you talking about? Like, I'm not perfect. I'm a human being. I make mistakes. But it goes beyond that. Like, when you talk about humanity, we are perfect as we are. You see a child and you're like, they're perfect. And that's the same person that we are. We were just, let's say, tainted by what he explains as the lies that people told us or made us believe. For example, when we tell kids, like, Johnny, you should be...
Johnny.
Couldn't think of a more, like, general name. In Spanish, it's like fulanito or fulanita, when you just don't want to say like generic name. But here, fulanito, this is how you're going to be, this is how you are a good boy, or this is how you are a good girl. And so, like, they might not say like you're bad, or, you know, like what the message is, like, you are not enough, or you are not good as you are. So you're not this good thing that we want you to be, or like you're not this person that we want you to be. And so all the issues, all the drama, all the problems in the world, he says, comes from us believing those lies. Like, really peaceful and pure living means in the truth. And so if we can kind of like take out those lies that either people told us, or the way they said things, said like, I'm not enough, or I'm not perfect, and our mind just like immediately goes to like, no, like that is not right, you know? And so for us to take out those lies that just reminds us of the truth. And I think in this movement is like, always be towards truth seeking. Like, yes, we are, it's like we're trying to work to change this system, or let's say interchange this system for something that works for us while we're working the system. So it's really a construction. And so what we really are is nothing related to this, but we still have to work in the system. So it is a lot of confusion in our minds of trying to be these perfect beings that we are, and live in this, as I say, in this system. So just offering that to all of you. I love Don Miguel Ruiz. The, what's it called, the other one?
The Mastery of Love.
Mastery of Love.
Great I'm being book. That student who's scribbling down the books right
now. He also wrote The Four Agreements.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
That's the most well-known one.
That's a really good one. That's a really good one.
That's great.
So let's seek the truth in whatever we are involved in. Let's seek the truth and really like critical thinking, or like just question everything and be like, is that really the truth? Because the truth always brings us peace and always brings us good things for everyone. The truth does not discriminate back from other people, you know? It's just, it's for everyone. And so I think it's like a good compass to follow. So that's it for today. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. Gets your mind thinking and connecting with your intuition about where you want to, what piece you want to take in this movement. Talking about civic duty, Victoria has a practice guide for us for this podcast episode. So can you share what's our practice for this week?
Oh, well, I'm glad you asked, because civic duty is our sub value. That was a beautiful transition. What an amazing bunch of transitions today. Okay, so civic duty is our sub value for this week, for election week. And that fits under the universal human value of right action. So as a reminder, the universal human values are truth, love, peace, nonviolence, and right action. So I guess civic duty could fit under a lot of those, but we chose right action because we need to get some action going up in here, so the thought of the week is, had to get a song in there. The thought of the week is from Sojourner Truth, and she had said, if we laugh and sing a little as we fight the good fight of freedom, it makes it all go easier. I will not allow my life's light to be determined by the darkness around me. Still relevant, and I think it needs to be brought to teaching kids about, you know, giving kids their civic education. Is it's joyous to be able to vote. You know, we didn't always get that, and a lot of people didn't always have that. The only people who always had that were white men. So it's a joyous thing to be at the table. It's a joyous thing to have our voices be heard. So we have to remember that. So with that, the objective is to make your voices heard and to demand freedom for all marginalized groups in our country. You all have the power to stand up for yourself, and you have the ability to fight for the safety of everyone. So use that power, use that voice that you have, use your knowledge, use your talents. And I also encourage you to listen to the Janelle Monáe song Americans, because it's very fitting, and it will give you some inspiration. And there's also a lot of literature about Black women and their fight for voting rights. So that kind of gets like washed over a lot in our social studies history classes, where it's just like, okay, 1920, women got the right to vote. Cool. Let's move on to 1930, the Great Depression. You know, it's very like, boop, that's it. They got it. Cool. Read a lot about the fight. Read about who was there at the fight. Read about, you know, the people, you know, that were there helping everybody get the right to vote. So that's your homework. That's your reading story time, is to read about those inspiring women, and mostly women of color. So,
can we get some?
Can I get an amen?
Can I get an amen?
Talking about homework, make sure you visit our Ko-fi accounts, ko-fi/Human Values Club, ko-fi. And leave us a little love there in the form of money, and share. Yeah, if you like this episode, you can let us know in that way as well. You can always reach out to us to our Instagram at Human Values Club, and Twitter. We also have a YouTube page where you can see some funny videos of us, and also Facebook. We have Facebook. Wow, we're everywhere. you won't miss us. So reach out to us, enjoy these conversations, and most of all, Let's remember that this movement is based on how we protect our joy. It should be a joyful endeavor. And I know it can be very hard, but the more we take care of ourselves, the more we can help other people and be strong to really be there for what we believe. So when we liberate ourselves, we liberate other people. And so it's not only about us, but also about just doing it for everyone. And so let's get to work. Work, work, work. All right.
Work, work, work.
I like the hand dancing. That's all I can do right now. All right, everybody. Awesome being with you. I hope you have a good weekend.
And Katie, thank you so much for joining us for your first podcast.
Yay!
Thank you for having me.
Hopefully you'll join us in the future.
I would love to.
A regular. thank you, Katie. Katie takes works a lot with our Instagram, so you can definitely reach her in our Instagram, Human Values Club. All right. Love yourself. Love the world.
Love the world.
And see you later.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.